Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Now, Robert Maxwell, he was viewed by many as the embodiment of corporate villainy. He was a larger-than-life character that nobody really, really knew. A new book from John Preston delves into the many names, backstories and tall tales attributed to Maxwell, as well as his obsession with Rupert Murdoch. The book is called Fall, subtitled The Mystery of Robert Maxwell, and John Preston joins me now on the line. John, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, this is an extraordinary story about an extraordinary man. And you bring us back at the beginning of your book to when he wasn't Robert Maxwell. He was somebody else.
Yes, he was born in this very small town in the west of what was then Czechoslovakia. And he came from a Jewish family. There were a lot of Jewish people in the area. When Maxwell's 16 or 17, about 16, he sets off to basically find his fortune. And whilst he's away, both his parents, three of his siblings and his grandfather are all killed in Auschwitz. So that is the kind of prism you really have to look at Maxwell's life through.
His origins, though, were not very hopeful. I mean, you talk about the Czechoslovak government trying to lure people to Ruthenia, which is where he came from, a tiny village there.
Yeah.
They said in their tourist blurb, the very best thing here is the fresh air. And the pamphlet also suggested that the Ruthenians were unusually thick, rather unintelligent. So for such a man with a massive intelligence to emerge from Ruthenia is quite remarkable.
Yeah, it is absolutely an astonishing story. And his mother had this strange conviction that her son Robert, although he wasn't Robert in those days, was going to be famous. And she would tell people this in the village and they would all fall about laughing. But of course, it turned out to be true. He did become, or tried to become, the greatest media baron in the world.
His story, he heads for Budapest. Eventually, he might have been actually tried and executed. He makes his way and joins various parts of the Allied forces before he finally sees combat in World War II, where I think the word swashbuckling would probably be an appropriate word for some of his activities.
Yes, that's certainly true. I mean, he actually won the Military Cross, which is one down from the Victoria Cross. And he was unquestionably extremely brave, but there was also a much darker, more ruthless side to his character. He shot the mayor of a small town in France in the town square in full view of the inhabitants to deter anyone from taking up arms against the British. And he may indeed even have shot unarmed German soldiers who'd already surrendered.
And you say that his soldiers who were with him said, you know, hang on a second, that's not on. They had surrendered. In other words, the whole idea of fair play, they understood, and he couldn't understand that concept.
I think that's true. I mean, you know, one of the many strange things about Maxwell is, you know, did he have a sense of morality? Well, yes and no. I mean, but it was pretty skewed and it never really held him back from getting what he wanted.
What is remarkable, and it's almost helter-skelter the pace of your book, that in the post-war era, he kind of very rapidly, through various tricks of the loop, became quite wealthy, or at least had the trappings of wealth. I mean, he was probably a con artist.
Well, I mean, I know what you mean, but nonetheless, by the mid-1950s, Maxwell, who, as you said, come from nothing, had turned himself into the biggest publisher of scientific journals in the world. And, you know, yes, he could have been selling, you know, sardines or fur coats, but nonetheless, he did actually believe in what he was doing. It's really only later that things start to get much, much darker.
He was likely a spy for the British government for many of those years, those post-war years. Isn't that so? Because he had, you know, a command of maybe half a dozen languages or more. He could move freely through Eastern Europe. And on one occasion, you write about him arriving in with a big box of documents in Moscow, supposed to be a list of publications of scientific material, but as they borrowed a camera to take pictures of them all before surreptitiously returning them to where he'd got them, and his wife said, you know, what's he at? He's got to be a spy. This is not kosher.
No, I mean, there's no doubt that he did work as a spy for British intelligence after the war. Just how long he carried on being a spy is a kind of moot point. He certainly loved kind of passing bits of information back and forth from one government to another. But whether he was, I mean, you know, Maxwell was the kind of complete opposite of what a spy is supposed to do, because he basically had to be the center of attention of any room that he walked into. So the idea that he would kind of operate behind a curtain, which spies normally do, would have been absolute kind of anathema to him.
Now, in his wartime years, he had many, many names. I mean, among them, Ivan de Moirier. So, in a sense, rooting the identity of Robert Maxwell, which he finally embraced, I mean, he kind of built up a whole mythology around himself and adopted some airs and graces, but sometimes his origins would reveal him.
Yes, he would say sort of weird things like you can't shut a stable horse after the door has bolted. But he would deliver it in this kind of extraordinary plummy English voice. He'd actually learnt English from listening to Winston Churchill's speeches on the radio, although he couldn't at the time understand a word that Churchill was saying. But yes, it was only, you know, periodically the mask would slip. And, you know, people would realise that, oh, hold on, maybe English isn't his first language after all.
Now, he famously, as I discovered in your book, lived in a council house for all his life. Explain.
Yeah, it was a hell of a council house. He lived in a house, a big, big mansion called Headington Hill Hall, which is just outside Oxford. And it happened to be owned by Oxford Council. So Maxwell leased it from them and would always boast that he had the best council house in the country, which was probably true. But it was strange for such a rich man not to be at all interested in possessions, really. And I mean, he never owned a property. And maybe that goes back to his childhood, that a kind of deep ingrained fear that if you put down roots, they were likely to be torn up again.
Now, moving on through his success with Pergamon Press, and his wife said he lived it, he breathed it. Everything was Pergamon Press. And he became, as you say, very successful, but not quite successful enough in his own mind. He saw Rupert Murdoch as, I suppose, first of all, an icon, but secondly, someone to be emulated and perhaps even superseded.
Yes, I mean, they were kind of, you know, they were locked in this titanic battle for 30 years. And Murdoch essentially won every round of the fight. Every time Maxwell would try and buy a newspaper, Murdoch would snatch it from underneath his nose. And it drove Maxwell nuts. And he really came to see Murdoch as his kind of nemesis. And indeed, it's actually his struggle to go toe-to-toe with Murdoch, particularly in America, that precipitated him on this path towards his financial downfall and his mental, physical disintegration, and ultimately his death.
The grand life that he lived, quite extraordinary. You tell of one tale where he's meeting the Kinnocks and they don't have a grand mansion to entertain him. Neil Kinnock being the leader of the Labour Party, who almost became PM, but not quite. And they entertained himself and his wife, Betty, in a local trattoria. And Betty and Robert Maxwell arrived in separate Rolls Royces for their dinner.
Yes, I mean, that may tell you something about the state of their marriage at the time, because they were certainly drifting apart. But they did lead a very, very lavish lifestyle. And, you know, Maxwell had more helicopters than anyone else in the country. And he loved to kind of whiz around and land in people's gardens. And, you know, he loved to, you know, drink the finest wines and eat kind of virtually bucketfuls of caviar. So, yes, he didn't stint himself at all, which is largely why he became so enormous.
What was the reason for his ultimate demise? Because we know after his death, he was still fated, you know, fell off the back of his yacht or decided to do himself in, who knows. But that's what happened to him. And he, even in death, he was praised and lauded until it emerged that he'd robbed the pension fund.
Yes, I mean, but essentially, what happened was that in 1988, 3 years before Maxwell died, he bought the US publisher Macmillan for an insane amount of money. I mean, $1 billion more than the company's own directors thought it was worth. And he did that because he wanted to slug it out with Murdoch in the States. But then, you know, there was a recession, interest rates rose. And from that moment on, he's constantly kind of trying to rob Peter to pay Paul and shuffling money around from one bit of his empire to another. And as you say, looting the Mirror pension funds. But when nobody, of course, knew any of this when he died. So he dies on November the 5th, 1991. The world leaders are queuing up to pay tribute to him and say what a fantastic man he was. And it's only 3 weeks later that quite a lot of the same people are also queuing up saying that he was a terrible villain and they'd always known there was something fishy about him. So, you know, he falls incredibly, his reputation falls incredibly far and incredibly fast.
He himself, though, was observed to be disintegrating before his demise. You know, he was becoming extremely obese, number one, but also becoming moody and almost depressed about what he'd achieved or not.
Yes, he became increasingly paranoid. And then you could sort of trace that back to, you know, his rivalry with Murdoch as well. He also fell in love with his PA, who was many decades younger than him. She went off and married somebody else. And that was another thing that kind of tipped him really into despair, actually. I mean, you know, he's enormously wealthy by this stage, but he lives, he's completely alone up in his flat on the top of his headquarters called inevitably Maxwell House. He just gorges himself on Chinese takeaways and watches old Clint Eastwood movies. It's a kind of sad story of someone who's backed himself into this terrible corner and has no friends and nowhere left to turn.
Now, many people listening to this program who are younger won't even know much about Robert Maxwell, except for the fact that his daughter, Ghislaine, came back in the news because of the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, which is still ongoing. She was his favourite daughter.
She was the youngest. And yes, she was his favourite child. That's why he named his yacht the Lady Ghislaine. So, yes, I think she was probably better at diffusing her father's pretty frequent rages than any of the other children.
Well, I have to say, John, the book is like a thriller and it gallops along and we've only skimmed the surface of what you reveal about Robert Maxwell, a quite extraordinary man, a quite extraordinary life, which ended in failure, I suppose. but you can't deny the energy and the ebullience and the life force that Maxwell was in his heyday.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, very few people lead incredibly vivid, epic, technicolor lives. And Maxwell, for all his flaws, unquestionably did.
Well, the book, as I say, it reads like a thriller. It's called Fall, The Mystery of Robert Maxwell. It's out now, and it's author John Preston. John, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.